Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
80 Proof Politics is brought to you by Big Wig Media, part of the Evergreen Podcast family. You can find this and other fascinating podcasts from our nation's capital at bigwigpodcast.com.
First one in my family to go into college, and first one to go into the military. But my dad did work for Boeing, and his dad worked for McDonnell Douglas before it was part of Boeing. So, you know, there's always an aviation influence there, and always liked airplanes from when I was a kid and wanted to fly. And that's what I did. Went to UVA and ROTC and into the Air Force straight to flight school and moved on from there.
Here we are, Memorial Day weekend. It's upon us once again, and once again, we don't have any plans. I mean, we never really travel on Memorial Day weekend. There's no beach or lake in it for us. The best day is really just firing up the grill and hanging out by the pool. But I do have one annual tradition. Each Memorial Day weekend, I watch Band of Brothers, that great HBO series. For me, it's like watching Wonderful Life at Christmas. It's just something I have to do. Because as the son of a World War II vet, Band of Brothers, for me, represents exactly why we honor those who serve and sacrifice for our freedom. And while my dad never did serve in the European theater, he did follow the Marines through the South Pacific as a photo intelligence officer in the U.S. Army Air Corps, the precursor to the Air Force. So on this special Memorial Day edition of 80 Proof Politics, it's fitting to be joined by Air Force Colonel John Christensen. John, thank you for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And by here, John and I are meeting at a classic D.C. spot called Off the Record. Now, if you're not familiar with Off the Record, it has been a stanchion of D.C. bars with its great comfy chairs, its kind of soft, somewhat dark atmosphere. Very much like an old-fashioned club is how I would describe it. But Forbes magazine has listed it as one of the world's best hotel bars. Now, they like to say they're the best place to be seen and not heard, so that's kind of ironic we're doing a podcast here. But the reason it's one of the best hotel bars is it is in the basement of the classic D.C. establishment, Hay Adams Hotel. And if you're not familiar with Hay Adams, you should make yourself familiar. It's a beautiful, elegant hotel right on the corner of 16th and H, across Lafayette Park from the White House, and it's got a fantastic history. Its origin story is that the renowned developer in the 1920s, John Wardman, purchased the old homes that were right here on this corner. One of them happened to be owned by John Hay, who was personal secretary to Abraham Lincoln and then went on to be an ambassador among many other things. The house next door was owned by Henry Adams. He was a renowned Harvard historian and, as you might guess by the name, a descendant of both John Adams and John Quincy Adams. It's a fabulous place that I highly recommend. Even if you go upstairs for their breakfast or their brunch, my wife's very partial to their eggs Benedict here, so I have to put in a plug for those as well. The reason that I invited John to join us here today is because in addition to his career in the Air Force, more on point to the theme of 80 Proof Politics, he's currently serving as military fellow at the Center for Strategic International Studies. So once again, dipping into the wealth of talent at CSIS. John, let me start there if I can.
Sure.
Tell me exactly what a military fellow is and the role that you play at CSIS?
Sure. So, you know, every service does military fellows a little bit differently. I can speak a little more in detail on how the Air Force does it. But in general, military fellows, the services send in place of either Staff College or War College, which are two periods throughout our career where we go to some sort of developmental education, sends them to be a fellow either at an organization, a think tank, academia, or other organizations around D.C., and in some cases around the country, to integrate with those organizations, broaden their horizon a little bit, as well as give those organizations exposure and access to some bit of military knowledge and really the rising leaders in the military. As far as on the Air Force side, the three types we have, there's National Defense Fellows, which is what the CSIS falls under, so that's what I am. Those are the ones that go to think tank or academia. You know, we have some at Harvard, some at Georgetown here in the city, and think tanks all over the city here in D.C., and to work in those think tanks, really to broaden your mind and think about some of those big problems, write them down on paper. I kind of joke with my civilian fellows at CSIS. I've got 22 years of pent-up ideas in my head from flying ops in the military, and I finally get to write them down now. So it's been a great year. And the outcomes for most National Defense Fellows, the Air Force at least looks to put us in, is to go to commander's action groups or on general staff somewhere in the Pentagon, either on headquarters Air Force staff or the joint staff, to have that integration back with the think tank and academic ecosphere in D.C. from the staff. The other two types of fellows, there's legislative fellows, fellows that work in a representative or a senator's office in Congress, and then they usually go to a legislative affairs office somewhere in the Pentagon afterwards to keep those connections. And the last type the Air Force has anyway is the strategic policy fellows, which work somewhere in the executive branch on their day-to-day basis during their fellowship. Any range of executive branch you can think of, that's where they work. And then they'll go into strategic planning positions in the Pentagon afterwards. There's some that work, you know, on White House staff. There's some that work, all the other departments, really. There's Homeland Security. There's Treasury. They're spread across the executive branch.
Right. What's the overall value to the branches of having military fellows take this time out of their career?
So really the value, especially for the War College level, the senior level, senior lieutenant colonels and colonels, they're looking at sending people who are going to be leaders in the Air Force and are those rising leaders to get them exposure to how the other branches of government and the other organizations within the city work, whether it be think tanks or, in a lot of cases, some of those academic institutions are targeted for the ones that do think tank-like work as well, in order to maintain that back and forth between the Pentagon and those ideas that are valid national defense concepts that come from outside the building. And then on the Air Force side specifically, we have our Air War College, which is down in Montgomery, Alabama, which, you know, most people ask why Montgomery. There was a reason at one time, you know, the Army Air Corps wanted to get away from the D.C. politics to develop those big ideas and how they would form an Air Force eventually. So that's why we're located, which was then in the middle of nowhere. But now it's a bigger city, and the War College is still there. And they use us, all the fellows, as essentially a distributed think tank to do some of that deep thinking that they would have done back in the day there, in what was called the Air Corps Tactical School.
Oh, sure. I remember that name. Then, on the front end of this process for you, do you apply to be a military fellow, or does someone come tap you on the shoulder?
Yep, you do apply for it. So, as I said, those two periods throughout an officer's career that they send you to developmental education is Staff College and War College. This is my War College equivalent. And instead of applying to go to either the Air War College or one of the other services schools or the joint school here in D.C., the National Defense University, you can also apply to fellowships. I had just moved up the year prior to D.C. with my family to work in the Pentagon for a year. And one of my big conditions is I wanted to stay in D.C. I didn't want to move my family again after only a year or so. Anyway, I applied to a lot of programs in D.C., and my academic background is all in international relations. So CSIS seemed like a great fit, and applied for it, and thankfully got it.
I imagine it would be a good fit, because I'm going to talk about your path to glory later in the second half, but let me throw a little background in here right now for our listeners' benefit. Before your career in the military. You got a BA in International Relations and Affairs at UVA.
Yep, Wahoo.
Yeah, great start. Fantastic. But then once in, you didn't stop there. You have no fewer than 3 master's degrees. One in International Relations and Affairs from the American Military University. One Air and Space Operational Art and Sciences from the Air Command and Staff College. And another in Military Operational Art and Science from the Army School of Advanced Military Studies. So you are truly a military scholar.
Yeah, you could see it that way.
But I can see why CSIS would be an appealing place for you.
Yes, CSIS is definitely an appealing place for me based on some of that academic background. Despite some of the fancy-sounding things in the resume, I do kind of enjoy learning. I'm a bit of a nerd, but some of those are the service schools that we sent to as staff college. And the second year, I got to do an extra year in that staff college period going to what we in the Air Force call Advanced Studies Group, which there's 4 schools to do it, one from each service. I got to go to the Army one at Fort Leavenworth. So I can joke I spent some time at Leavenworth, too.
by design, though.
Yeah. But all of them were very rewarding. The Army one had some IR in there as well, too, some IR theory, which was great.
Well, you must enjoy writing as well as thinking.
Yeah, more than I did when I was a kid, for sure. So it's definitely something that's caught on a little bit later in my life with me, and I'm just hoping some of my high schoolers catch on to that too eventually.
Yeah. Had you published anything before you had joined CSIS?
So not specifically, no. I have my master's thesis from one of those schools that's out there through Army Press, I believe, but it's not something I really pursued beforehand, just the pace of operations being... You know, military officer and flying, I didn't really have a lot of time to do that, which is, as I've joked, I've had all those pent-up ideas, so now I got a chance to actually sit down and write some of them down and publish both within CSIS and some other sites outside of CSIS as well.
Did you know virtually all vessels traveling in the U.S. have to be American-built, owned, and crewed? That's thanks to the Jones Act, which is the bedrock of the American maritime industry.
On the American Maritime Podcast, we cover the topics that matter most to the 650,000 men and women of American maritime, while also being accessible for the average listener to learn about this industry.
Every episode features a new guest, including congressional leaders, senior military officials, leading policy analysts, and other experts.
Come aboard and listen wherever you get your podcasts,
or watch on the American Maritime Partnership's YouTube channel.
I want to ask you, I was looking at some of your recent publications at CSIS. It's fascinating work. I want to ask you about a couple of them in particular. You seem to have a real knack or an interest in the international strategic defense investment. And with everything happening in Ukraine and the expansion of NATO, I imagine that's a pretty hot topic right now.
Oh, it definitely is. I think with both NATO and their new pledges for defense spending across many of those countries, the situation in Ukraine, even within the United States, looking at the rise of technology, I think, with the drones and some of those issues you mentioned, give us a lot more problems to think about than we would have had to with just propeller-driven aircraft, World War II on space as a warfighting domain. So you'll see, I think, especially over the next couple decades, a huge increase in the talk and the discussion on space operations as you have in the last 70, 80 years on air. One of the assignments I got to do was an exchange tour with the U.S. Navy flying EA-6Bs and later EA-18Gs, which are radar jamming aircraft. So I had a lot of experience coming from that, working within the electromagnetic spectrum.
That seems to fit with one of the pieces you wrote that I looked at, in which you stated that the electromagnetic spectrum is the next high ground. Explain that for us.
And I think the electromagnetic spectrum is an area we often overlook, as I said in that piece I think you're referencing from War on the Rocks. Not because it's not important, but it's just something that we haven't had to use to a great extent for the last 20, 25 years or so. It's something that's always been there. You know, it's not specifically labeled a domain by the Department of Defense or the U.S. government, like air, land, sea, space are, or cyberspace. But it is something that, you know, if humans weren't here, it would still exist. So we need to understand how we can operate in that and how we need to essentially dominate it, because all our equipment, all our data links, all our communications, radars, it all uses the electromagnetic spectrum to transit and operate in. And our adversaries know that. They know we fight as a connected force, and that they are going to do everything they can to take that spectrum away from us. So we need to be able to protect and exploit it in order to fight our nation's battles.
Yeah, what an important asset. You don't think of it that way, but you're exactly right. Goodness. And in a similar vein to that, you've also written a bit about artificial intelligence and the future of the military. Artificial intelligence has been a part of our lives for some time. It just happens to be hot right now.
Yeah, it definitely does.
How do you see that as an operational or a defensive threat?
So, yeah, artificial intelligence was a bit of a new exploration area for me coming to CSIS. And one of my co-writers, Di Cook, she is, you know, an artificial intelligence focused fellow there, and we just started talking one day and we struck up a relationship, and I heard a podcast actually riding to work one day about every new technology, they do dumb things with it because we overtrust it. And you see all these portrayals of artificial intelligence where you know, oh, I'll never trust a computer to do that, it's going to be Terminator, Skynet's going to rise, right? Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, and that's what we think of artificial intelligence generally as humans, that, oh, we're not going to trust that, that's dangerous. And yet every time we've been given new technology, whether it's anti-lock brakes or seat belts or new football helmets, I think was referenced in that article too, we act more dangerously with them because we assume it to be safe. And you can translate into that the things post. You can translate that into the things people post online, personal information, all that. Everybody trusts software more than they probably should.
Or every time you log in.
Exactly. So taking that conversation I had with Di, as well as our Navy fellow, Stiles Hurt there, and translate that into, like, hey, the military is getting serious about artificial intelligence, and we're a little bit behind the ball game, to be frank. And I should have said this at the front, that these are all my opinions and don't represent the opinions of the or official positions of the United States Air Force Department of Defense.
Fair enough. We won't hold them to it.
We're a bit behind the ball game, in my opinion, on artificial intelligence, and not through any fault, I think, of the DODs. It's just that's not something we have thought about because we've been focused on, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan for several decades. Same thing, we're behind on some other things. Because that's what our nation asked of us at the time, and that's what we pursued. But we need to catch up quickly. So the point of the article was, as artificial intelligence evolves into the defense space, what we need to do to make sure we don't make some of those mistakes that have happened in the civilian world with it, i.e. Tesla's why it drives into the side of a fire truck, right? So we need to make sure we don't go down that path in the Department of Defense. I think we have some good frameworks already, both with how we conduct flight training, how we conduct aviation safety, that we can apply to make sure that that doesn't happen, not just in the aviation space, but across the DoD.
It seems like it's going to be an ongoing challenge for decades to come.
Any new technology is, and as I'm sure you well know, working in D.C. for a while, that we are not the fastest to evolve and acquire new technology in the U.S. government sometimes.
It's very true. Your caveat about expressing your own opinions raises a question as well about your publications. I assume you have to vet everything you write.
We do, yeah. So everything that I write goes through, since as a fellow I'm attached to Air University down at Maxwell, so it goes through their public affairs office there for both security and other vetting. And then if there's something they feel that they can't handle, their level gets sent to the Secretary of Air Force Public Affairs in the Pentagon. Only happened to me once, though. Usually I can get it through Air University pretty quick.
Oh, that's good. So I imagine that process means that when you write something with a co-author, you have to first share your piece internally.
So, yeah, if I'm writing something with a co-author that is not military, and every service has their own different vetting process, so I can't speak for the other service fellows. But if I'm writing something with a co-author that's not military, we'll usually write it and go back and forth, and we'll send it to our copy editor to make sure our English is correct, and, you know, we're following the CSIS publications guide or whatever publication we're publishing with. And it's at that point I'll send it off to the PA people, and they'll vet it, because I don't want to send it too soon, because things might change in editing and standard stuff like that. But we do share it back and forth internally before I go there. I mean, we're all fellows are pretty senior people. We know how to not write classified things down on a piece of paper that shouldn't be. So that's not really too much of a worry.
Good. Very good. Yeah, you don't want to stifle the creative process, but you are in kind of a netherland in that regard.
Yeah. But it is good that they give us a huge amount of academic freedom. Like, I've never really had pushback on anything I wanted to publish. Obviously, let me do podcasts and other media interviews, too. So it's both for, you know, my future career in the Air Force, whatever that might be, and my future career after the Air Force, whatever that might be. As I said, I kind of rediscovered this love of writing, so hopefully maybe I can parlay that into something in a few years. We'll see how things go.
Well, I know as an Air Force colonel, you don't have 100% say on your future career.
That's anybody in the military. It's not just based on rank. We don't have a say. We can express preferences, and they tell us what they need us to do. It's always worked out. Every assignment I have had has been a great experience for both me and my family.
What would your preferred career path be after leaving CSIS? You mentioned wanting to stay in the area.
I already know where I'm going next. I'm going to Eglin Air Force Base to be the Vice Wing Commander of the 350th Spectrum Warfare Wing. It's the EW reprogramming wing for the Air Force, and oddly enough, they are getting into the AI space there as far as machine learning and AI-enabled reprogramming. So something that I kind of got into just out of an interest at CSIS. Hopefully that'll be helpful. Yeah. After that, I'm going to continue in the Air Force as long as they, you know, will let me, essentially. At some point, everybody is not overtly told it's time to go, but, you know, not everybody's going to be a four-star general, right? So, you know, as long as they keep giving me interesting things to do and I'm enjoying it, which has happened for 22 years so far, I'm in it for the long haul. Or as long as my wife lets me keep doing it.
Well, when you said the powers that be.
The powers that be include, you know, commander of the house.
Did you start your career right out of college?
I did, yeah. As you mentioned, I graduated from University of Virginia. I partially paid for by an ROTC scholarship. So actually, first one in my family to go into college and first one to go into the military. So it was an interesting experience. Into the U.S. military, I just said, always liked airplanes from when I was a kid and wanted to fly. And so that's what I did. Went to UVA and ROTC and into the Air Force straight to flight school and moved on from there.
Gosh, how many posts have you had since then?
This is my 12th post in 22 years.
You have moved around.
Yeah, yep. Wife's been with me through all of it because she also, I met her at UVA, so it's been a great ride.
Any overseas?
No, I haven't, oddly enough. I've deployed overseas many times, but I've never actually been assigned overseas. So, not for lack of trying, but as you mentioned earlier, we don't always get a say in where we go.
What, among all of those postings, was perhaps the most transformative for you?
Oh, man. As I said, all of them are very rewarding in their own way. I don't think I have actually had a bad one, you know. Like any organization, there's good squadrons and, you know, some maybe not, you know, the best at times. Although we do have the best Air Force in the world, I should preface it with that. But, you know, certain groups of people gel better than other groups of people, right? And I've been lucky enough that every place I've been, we've been a group that has gelled really well together. All the flying squadrons I've been in, you know, my kids were asking me about this the other day. I don't know how to explain it better to somebody that hasn't been in a Air Force fighter or bomber squadron. Then, like, it's like if you're in a very high performing athletic team that's doing really well in the locker room, they're all best buds. Like that's how a flying squadron is, right? So that's the only analogy I have in my lifetime, you know, of what I could compare it to. So it's always a great experience, you know, going out and performing the mission well with your best friends, essentially. So every one of those flying assignments is great. For specific transformative ones, I'd say the Air Force Weapons School, I got a chance to instruct there, which was awesome. It's everybody that has gone to the Air Force Weapons School or taught at the Air Force Weapons School kind of hates this analogy, but it's the best one to use for the wider public, is it's the Air Force's Top Gun.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I can see why there'd be some resistance.
We don't like to give the other service credit sometime, but even though the Air Force started their weapons school first.
There you go. There's a plug.
Yes. And I actually, funnily enough, I actually went through the Navy weapons school to go teach at the Air Force weapons school. That's a whole other story that we can get, we can get into another time, but teaching there was amazing. It is, you know, you fly in these large formations of aircraft using the most up-to-date tactics. You're developing those tactics yourself with the students. It's like the best aviators that you can find around the Air Force that go to this school, and now it's expanded beyond aviation, right? We've got, you know, a JTAC school there. There's an Intel school there, which is actually there from the beginning, so it kind of expanded beyond aviators fairly quickly. But all these specialties that go into conducting an air operation well, and what makes us the best Air Force in the world is because we have these weapons school students. When they graduate, they are weapons instructors and go back to all the squadrons in the Air Force and teach those squadrons to be the best. So being at the spear of that was an awesome experience. In addition, command, everybody says command is one of the best experiences in their life, and I agree. Like, my squadron command, even though it was in the middle of COVID and that came with all its challenges and all the lockdowns, it was a really transformative experience, mentoring the younger officers that are upcoming and shaping their careers and getting them to the places they wanted to be. That's personally very rewarding and something I hope to continue to do more of in the future. And then this year at CSIS, like I said, got all those pent up ideas and, you know, get to, you know, follow some of my foreign policy roots to write about some of that. And, you know, we've mentioned a lot of my military-focused writing, but I've got to do some stuff that's not quite through our publications process yet on non-military-focused, you know, stability, peace-building, and just interagency cooperation as well. So focused on some of those ideas have been great. And I did some of that with Errol Yabake, who I believe you had on this podcast a few weeks ago as well. So.
Well, I look forward to seeing those. John, I usually ask my guests if they have some sort of poignant advice for someone starting out in a career like you've had. What would you say to a young individual who may be in high school or maybe wrapping up college about joining the Air Force?
Yeah, I would say it's an amazing career. I've had a lot of fun. There's nowhere else that I've run across that you're going to have the type of experiences that I've had. It's been awesome. And once you're in the Air Force, especially if there's any young officers out there listening, I think there'll be some institutional wisdom that you'll get as far as you got to do certain things at certain times and stay within your community. And I think I'm kind of proof that you don't necessarily always have to do that. Obviously, still go to the schools, do the development education you need to do, but you know, follow your passions, and if something sounds fun, do it. Because, you know, when your Air Force career is done, this experience is where you're going to have left, right? So do what sounds rewarding at the time.
Fantastic. What? Any Memorial Day plans for you and your family?
So, I mean, we've got an upcoming move, so there's gonna be a little cleaning of the house, purging some stuff we may not need in the next move. Hopefully, get out on the boat a little bit, but we'll see what the weather's like. So,
the boat. Do you want me to edit that out for your Air Force friends?
Yeah. No. They know I'm going to Florida, and I'm going to spend a lot of time fishing while I'm there on my spare time when I'm not at work, for if my next boss is listening. But
oh, that's fabulous. Well, I hope you enjoy your weekend.
But I do think Memorial time is a great time to also reflect on you know, the people who have given everything for the country. And as you said, you've got relatives that served. I did not, at least for the U.S. My mom's parents immigrated from England with her, and just luck and timing wise, I guess nobody in my dad's family ever served. So, but there are lots of people, not just given their careers to the country, but given their lives for the country. And I think we don't have the country that we have now without that, without the people willing to stand up and do that. So, reflect on that.
Well, I certainly agree with that. It was a pleasure talking with one of those today.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.